Picasso leans out of the window, looks out on the ghetto, changing the shapes he sees. His old friend El Greco soon is expected, now just an echo of Spanish Sea. And outside the people stare, wondering what's going on in there. Tossing eggs, they pay the price so they can compare. And the holy works of love and reverence fell before the floods of Florence. The shop girls go out to the galleries, spending their salaries, see if they catch a hold. They meet an old master like some unknown lover. For some unknown reason, he's never old. And the auctioneer clears his throat. What am I bid for this bottled boat? A tap on the rail, sunk with a sail, but soon she's afloat. And the holy works of love and reverence fell before the floods of Florence. Griffith pulls on his whiskey. The mad room is misty, covered with yesterday. The girl is so pretty, she asks for a memory. He touches her knee and she fades away. But the box office line is long, the spectacular show is on. Thirsty for thrills, the fountain is filled with dreams of the dawn. And the holy works of love and reverence have fallen to the floods of Florence. The troubadour comes from the country, falls by the factory, sliding on simple strings. Armed with his anger, he sings of the danger. He senses a stranger is in the wind. But the fledgling has learned to fly. All the innocence leaves his eye. Echoes explode, rolled from the road, the melody dies. And the holy works of love and reverence fell before the floods of Florence.
And that's an old Phil Oakes song, Floods of Florence, which I haven't heard in many years. I'm going to play a few more before the show is over, maybe one or two more. And let's turn now to Berkeley. First, we're going to hear an interview by J.C. Orton. Played an interview or two of his in the past. J.C. is the distributor of Street Spirit, the newspaper, which you can get, usually, when they're open, at the Sub Rosa Cafe. That's on Pacific Avenue, about a block from Laurel Street, right near the bike church. You can also get a copy by flagging me down if you can see me running around in my new sticker car. I finally picked up a new car, kind of an old car, but it's not sticker covered yet, but it eventually will be, probably. You can also give me a call at 423-4833, and I'll get you a copy of Street Spirit, or check the main library, or go online to thestreetspirit.org. Current issue has a history of the blues, an elaborate, lengthy coverage of that history by editor Terry Messman. Usually it covers a lot of homeless issues. This time it's covering this particular issue. Anyway, JC also does a lot of other stuff. He's with the Catholic Worker. God, I met him a couple decades ago. And I caught up with him while I was picking up the latest issue of the December Street Spirit and ran some questions by him, which you get to hear.
Last night at this homeless
program. So I'm talking with
J.C. Orton.
And you're giving me a memorial poem you wrote?
Yes, that's right. I call it A Story of Thanksgiving. This dark-skinned couple, a confused father and a very pregnant teenage mother with a great concern about the real father in question, came into town with nowhere to stay and were forced to find a slightly sheltered place for the night. The following day was her day, and the family expanded to three. Unfortunately, the local authorities had a warrant out, and they were forced to move before being arrested or worse. They were forced to travel 3 or 4 days to a place of refuge. No money for the bus or train at that point. A new mother, a newborn infant, and a stand-in father ending up in unfamiliar surroundings with people speaking a foreign language. Their interim wait to go home took almost 3 years until they were able to go back home. Strangely, their original home, in their absence, had remained none the worse to wear, or so we are told. The family endured the comings and goings, bringing up Junior, even losing him on their annual trip to the big city. Lux was with them, and they found him before CPS did. The child grew up learning important job skills from his father and stepfather. The family did well enough for the next few decades, with the son leaving the family and becoming an itinerant preacher. Some of you may have guessed that this story of homelessness is one we have heard before, but we do not consider the beginning of our Christian faith has roots in homelessness.
That's J.C. giving you a mystery guest inquiry. If you can guess the identity of that, give a call to 423-4833, and I'll put you in touch with J.C. J.C., what about pregnant women in Berkeley who are homeless? Any reports? You've been doing this for decades now. You do the Night on the Streets Catholic Worker. Is that actually the official name of the group you're working with?
Been that way 20 years, yeah. That's you got the right name, yeah.
It's a van you distribute Street Spirits.
And that's Night with a N, not a K, as you originally put it together back about 20 years ago.
I would never have done
you
that.
You misspelled it.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Likely story. You distribute food. You distribute occasionally candles to vigils. You make them available. What else do you do that justifies your existence?
Depth of hospitality. You can give out stuff. You can give people a pat on the back, but maybe give them a little bit of focus. Not tell them all the answers. Listen to them, and maybe you understand what the questions really are. Listen to what they have to say.
What have you learned, let's say, in the last year that you didn't know before, if anything?
Well, progressively over the years, that's as sick as it sounds, I got job security.
So you're one of these poverty bureaucrats, poverty-crats we've heard so much about? Poverty pimps, perhaps?
There's no money in it for me. Not for doing this.
Well, you are living indoors. I'm standing at your house. Yeah. In a garage full of goodies that you actually distribute, I would assume, or store for others.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you are a little concerned because there's been sort of a slowdown in charity and a slowdown in newspaper distribution.
Well, newspapers isn't all of it. I think the idea that we're making more and more converts to caring, whichever brand name that takes. There's more people out there. We're pulling them out of schools and high schools and colleges and grade schools, kindergartens, seminaries, Catholic schools, all sorts of religious schools, UU Seminary, the Jesuit School of Theology. We're getting out to people that are supposed to be doing that anyway, and we're getting them to come out of the woodwork and coming out of their rectories and their whatever their official thing is, and getting them to come out here and putting a little dirt under their fingernails and getting them to go and associate and understand that these people out here are not just so much a human flesh. We have a responsibility because they are our neighbor.
Now, in the last month, give me some examples of how you have
because the entrenched, established, and routinely roboticized seminary students and other middle-class folks to get off their duffs and actually get out among the people.
Well, we get everybody out of their duffs. It's satisfying when I go up to the Jesuit school and draw the seminarians, so to speak, the lay people that are up there, the teachers that are up there, all those folks, to get them out, because I know it's important to study what's going on, but also the key to it is field work and understanding by experience.
We know the theory. I'm looking for the specifics in the last month. How many people have you gotten on the streets in the last month who are middle-class dorks who are now hopefully about to be awakened by this kind of activity?
Well, I think they were awakened for sure before they got into it. They wouldn't be doing what they're doing if they were just doing it for the book learning.
You're still skipping my question.
Yeah, well, I'm skating around it.
There you go. Let's see if he breaks through the ice here.
No, there's people out there that have cared all the time. What we do is we give them the opportunity to be caring.
And how many in the last... This is the third time I've asked you this. Have you actually gotten out to do this month? It being December and Christmas and all that shit.
I don't like to think of Christmas as a time of giving. I think the whole year is a time of giving.
Thank you, Scotty. I'll try a fourth time, then I'll go home. How many? Please tell me.
Oh, I guess we'll probably get another 6 or 8 new people that have come that have never come before and from lots of different places, not just from the seminaries.
Now, is that average by the month or just this particular month?
People come, people go, people leave town, people come new into town, they hear about us, they get involved, they find out it's tough to get out on Sunday morning, then they start bringing their sister or their brother or their kid or their husband. They come from Walnut Creek. See, who comes a distance? Our longest person, long-distance person is all the way from India.
Compared with a year ago, would you say the number of folks that are coming to do this kind of work is increasing, decreasing,
yes,
staying the same?
Increasing, definitely increasing.
By about what factor?
Oh, maybe 20%. Numbers is not the point.
So
the point is that we got
5 to 6 per month.
5 or 6. No, this we got maybe 30, 40 people to come out on some of our Sundays here. Next Sunday, we've got it's going to be Christmas Eve Sunday, and we're planning on bringing out all sorts of goodies. Put it on hold for a second there.
So you just
continue.
We're waiting for
him
to take. Okay. You just took a call advising someone the specific instructions how to get to a shelter that opens up tonight. What is the shelter capacity in Berkeley, as far as you know, and how many people would you estimate tonight because of the, even assuming it were filled, will not be able to get shelter outside?
That particular shelter, which is the Berkeley Emergency Storm Shelter, it's funded by the City of Berkeley, will have somewhere between 30 and 50 people tonight. If it gets 50, that'd be real good. The city has plans, at which point I'm not in a position of where I can explain exactly.
I resist interrupting you. I don't want to hear about plans. I want to hear about tonight.
Tonight, between 30 and 50.
And how many people in the city will not be sheltered?
All the people, less those 30.
And who will 50. They be? What's that? What's your estimate?
Well, there's going to be hundreds. There's going to be 400 or 500 people. Some of them are going to be not going to be in the shelters because they don't like shelters. They don't do shelters. Shelters are not the answer.
Are there reasons why you would advise someone not to go to a shelter here in Berkeley?
No. I think the shelters are there. I think it's a matter of choice. If we get the shelters filled up, it means we've got 40 or 50 people that last night were sleeping out in the rain, and today they'll be in the cold, or rather be in the warm and in the dry, and probably it'll be we'll have some food served there of some sort. I'm not sure exactly what's going to be happening, but it'd be a better choice than freezing one's butts off.
I've heard many people criticize shelters who are homeless themselves and some who aren't. But you, of course, you're a shelter provider, and you would be, shall we say, speaking against your own work.
Wait a second. I've got to straighten that out. I retired from the shelter here about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and they passed it on to a couple other people to take care of it.
But you don't want to diss your former job.
Right? Well, I'm not dissing anything. I'm just saying that I am not the shelter person anymore.
Right.
The funny thing is if people keep calling me up because they figure I'm going to know what's going on, where it is, how it is, who it is.
But you would keep advising people to go. You just told me that.
I do. I do.
Yes, of course you do.
Present tense. Not something that's going to happen.
So you don't see drawbacks to these shelters that you would say caution people about?
Well, the caution is
theft,
that
illness, regimentation.
Well, to some degree, there got to be some order to it. It's not helter-skelter, because if it's that way, shelters don't work out. And you have something sort of like the old shelter at China Basin of 20 years ago, which was a real zoo. There's 500-600 people in one big building, whereas now they're just 40 or 50.
That's China like Basin was in Berkeley?
No, that was over in San Francisco in China Basin Air, right there.
You were working with that one at one point?
To some small degree, yes.
Uh-huh.
But we're anticipating the city here in the next two or three days to literally ramp up. So what you're asking me is for answers to questions that I cannot answer until Thursday or Friday.
Well, we'll have to get back to you at that point. But I also wanted to – you probably heard about the first that came for the homeless lawsuit that unsuccessfully tried to stop the BART authorities, colluded in by the city, from evicting them from their spot. The judge in that case, you may remember, asked both the city and the attorneys for the campers to give a possible solution. Campers came up with all kinds of places where people could set up emergency campgrounds. The city's response was, at least the opinion of the campers, and I haven't talked to city officials about this, we've got lots of great plans, but really we can't house everyone. Yeah. And gee, we're working real hard. But there was no specific program as requested by the judge. What's your reaction to this?
Well, I think it's going to take more than just the city going and throwing dollars at it and different organizations trying to chip in and to make a difference. I think it's going to take the community to make the difference. And when we get the community on board, when the community as a whole or as a great majority decides they're going to do something about that rather than just, you know, well, wouldn't it be nice if they became the answer rather than waiting for the answer to come from someplace else. So if they would need to get personally involved. That's going to change the whole face of homeless.
And of course,
when people decide to get personally involved and actually do it.
And that's what First They Came for the Homeless and the community around it that supported them, I'm told, did on numerous occasions, even after the police moved in time after time to evict them. Do you have a different understanding of that?
I pretty much agree with that statement, yes.
And so the issue is, I guess... You're right. I mean, but the issue, the city certainly has the resources to set up sanctioned campgrounds if they wanted in different places, at least if you believe there's any credibility to the proposals made by the attorneys for First They Came for the Homeless. Do you have any objections yourself to sanctioned campgrounds as emergency shelter when there's no other alternatives?
The simple answer is no.
I appreciate that. I want to give you a chance to give your final thoughts, and then I will let you get back to what you told me is really a busy schedule for you today.
Okay. Well, I think what it's going to take is we're going to have to take the commandment, the idea of love your neighbor. And love your neighbor is something you can do at a distance, at an arm's length, or you can say, well, that's somebody else's problem. So if we take the stance that we do love our neighbor and we're going to do something about it, something that's substantial, something that's perhaps uncomfortable, something that's going to take more than just, well, wouldn't it be nice if somebody else were to take care of it? It's going to take that personal responsibility. And personal responsibility is what the Catholic Worker, to a great degree, is about. Taking that personal responsibility to make sure that people have something to eat, that people are cared for, and that somebody's going to give them just a little bit of hope. And then as the people are able to pull themselves out of the mud and the muck of just being despondent about everything, when they can do that, then perhaps they can step out of the situation of just being homeless to being housed. And it's at such a point, maybe they find themselves some jobs, they find better living situations, and they end up being treated as, oh my God, human beings.
Well, I won't dare to mention the Pope's solicitous regard for a cardinal who covered up thousands of cases of abuse that was in today's media, but I do mention it because you use the word Catholic, and I believe that in associating yourself with that kind of a hierarchy, although I think you are entirely different in your actual behavior than that, although I haven't examined your sexual proclivities, that's another issue. We haven't gone into that one yet. I'm giving myself the last word, which is not fair. You have the last word.
Well, I think you better be careful about what you say, but your batteries might run out before I have my full say about it.
No, you're too busy to keep talking to me.
Yeah, well, on that note, you've got a lot of information and hopefully get people thinking about things and, more importantly, get off their dust and do it.
Thank you, J.C. We've been talking with
J.C. Orton from the Catholic Worker here in Berkeley.
People can get more information about the Catholic Worker by doing what?
Just Googling J.C. Orton on a Google search. You find out all sorts of crazy things about what we're doing and decide to involve yourself with us. And you don't have to come to Berkeley to do it. There's needs in Palo Alto. There's needs in Los Altos. There's needs in
Santa Cruz.
And maybe even Santa Cruz, where this guy I'm talking to is.
Come.
There's a need all over. So if you get the idea and it goes and stirs something inside of you, hopefully it's more than just indigestion.
And with that, thank you, J.C. Orton.
You're welcome.
Millionaires
and paupers walk the hungry streets. Rich and poor companions of the restless feet. Strangers in a foreign land, strike a match with trembling hand. Learn too much to ever understand. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady. Lovers quarrel, snarl away their happiness. Kisses crumble in a web of loneliness. Written by the poison pen. Horses break before they bend. Door is slammed, it's over once again. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady. Poets agonize, they cannot find the words. And the stone stares at the sculptor, asks, are you absurd? Painter paints his brushes black, through the canvas runs a cry. Portrait of the pain never answers back. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady. Smoke dreams of escaping souls are drifting by. Dull the pain of living as they slowly die. Smiles change into a sneer washed away by wasted tears in the quicksand of their mind. They disappear. But nobody's buying flowers. Almost to their knees. They complain about the present using memory. Never found their pot of gold. Wrinkled hands bound weary home. Each line screams out, you're old, you're old, you're old. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady. And the flower lady hobbles home without a sail. Tattered shreds of petals leave a fading trail. Not a pause to hold the rose. Even she no longer knows. Lamp goes out, the evening now is closed. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady. Yes, nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady.
And that was Phil Oakes, Quiet Night, Chicago, Illinois, March 17th, 1974, a year or two before he killed himself. And it's a different quality to it. Actually, it's easier to understand the lyrics of that particular version of Flower Lady if you're a Phil Oakes fan, as I am. And it's a good song. Coming up next, it's Mike Zint of Berkeley, activist with First They Came for the Homeless, although he himself is currently housed and fighting to keep his housing in Berkeley. We've had a number of interviews with him in the past, and this is another one. So here it comes. So I'm on the line with Mike Zint of Berkeley. It's December 23rd, 2017, about, I don't know, 3:30, a little after in the afternoon. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm pretty good indoors. That's nice. How are you doing? You were doing a rent struggle last time I talked to you.
Well, that's still going on. We don't have a legitimate story on why the rent went up. Going up to half of my paycheck is going to stress my budget, but there's a lot of people that are going to help me try to maintain the roof over my head.
Did you find out whether the company is raising rents for other people in your building or other people in...
I can't tell. I got a letter from my worker at the hub who said that this is a year-end increase and everybody's getting it. I don't know if that's true. I haven't heard from anybody else, but I'm not the only one who got a rent increase. Mike Lee also got a rent increase.
Right. What about other non-activists?
I don't know. I don't know. And remember, these rent increases came in a month after our lawsuit got filed.
And tell our listeners again what the status of that lawsuit is and where it's at.
Well, it just got postponed. So I don't know exactly what's going on. I just got the email this morning. Apparently, and this is ironic, for those who know the history of First Day Camp for the Homeless, we started in Berkeley working with the postal office, occupying the post office. Well, Judge Alsip, who is our class action lawsuit judge, is the same judge as the Berkeley post office judge, which our next court date, both cases are going to be in front of the judge.
And tell us what the issues are in those two cases.
So the post office has to do with they tried to sell it, and we fought back. We went into occupied for 17 months to help stop the sale, but there were two groups working on it. It was Save the Berkeley Post Office and the Berkeley Post Office Defense, which is BPOD, which is who we were working closely with. One group handled the legal side of things, which was not our group. Our group handled the occupation. And the legal side of things has to do with the zoning overlay that they put in to prevent the building from being sold. The Department of Justice thinks that that's illegal, and that's where the lawsuit about the post office is coming in. They're trying to sue to get rid of that. And then after they get rid of that, they'll, of course, put the building back up for sale. And the other thing is the class action lawsuit against Berkeley on the homeless situation. That's still up in the air, and I really don't know what's going on. I'm in loose communication with the attorneys, but I want to leave them alone and let them dedicate all their time that they have, all their spare time, to working on the lawsuit.
Now, of course, for those who don't know, that's a lawsuit between, for First They Came for the Homeless, that essentially asked for, the judge asked for both parties. They tried to stop the eviction from the initial site.
Right.
Or I should say the 16th or 17th site, but, you know, the site that you were at or that they were at, because you moved from them, you got into housing, and your health was declining, so you were, part of the, I don't know, would you call that, a necessary move you had to do in order to simply...
Yeah, I need a plug. And that's what it comes down to. I need to have a plug at my disposal for my nebulizer in case I have a breathing issue.
So you moved, but the encampment, First They Came for the Homeless, continued until it was attacked by BART, I guess, and in collusion with Berkeley.
It's not over. What they did when they raided the Here There encampment is they broke us into three. And each of those encampments is separate and is being run by the people in the camps as it was designed. And at this point, all three of those camps are growing.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of just having one camp that's getting to be 30 people, now they've got three camps. We've got City Hall. City Hall is covered. I don't know if you've seen the photos. City Hall is covered. We've got the entire front lawn. We got the side lawn. And I don't know. I haven't seen pictures recently, the last week or so. I do not know if we've got the in front of the police station covered yet, but that's what they were working on last night.
Yeah, I was up when there. About a month and a half ago, I was up there, and I spoke. At that point, there were, I think, 10 tents. Apparently, it's grown since then. Plus,
oh, yeah.
You have one down at Aquatic Park.
It's powered. Did you see the East Bay Express article? I can send it to you. Tom Lochner covered the over 2,000 watts of solar panels that we've installed in our three camps. And this is being done by Sam, who is at the Aquatic Park camp.
So the third part, the third camp is on the other side of Adeline Street from where you were, Here There, also previously known as First They Came for the Homeless, was before it was evicted by BART, right?
Yeah, the Here There camp, that one fractured. Now, the third camp is still there. We're still at Here There. But we've moved off of the fenced-off area and set up right next to the porta-potties that we're still paying for. The South Berkeley porta-potties that First They Came for the Homeless and Friends of Adeline worked together to get them put in. and Friends of Adeline is currently paying for these porta potties. And this is a community organization that has been paying for these porta potties for months now. And these are South Berkeley's porta potties. So why is a private organization or private group paying for something that city council said put in? You know, it's just one of those weird questions.
How would you say the situation has changed, if at all, in the last year between December of 2016 and 2017 for the majority of homeless people and encampments in Berkeley?
They have gotten a break. You know, with what we're doing, we managed to suck in a lot of resources last year and get a lot of attention, make the city look bad, which kind of slowed them down. And the mayor, the current mayor, Jesse, said that, you know, he's going in and he's going to change things and the raids are going to stop and all these things. And, you know, to some extent it's happened. But guess what? Yesterday they raided not one of our encampments, but across the street from the Here There encampment is a lady named Anna who's got a tent there. You know, really big tent. She's got a house out there. And she had a couch and a bed. It was great. She had a nice little setup going. Well, last week the tent got set on fire, and our crew went over and put the fire out. And yesterday the police went in and pretended like it was all abandoned, and they started taking everything, and our crew was right there, and we got it on video. We got some nasty stuff on video. The cops said that they don't need to serve notice. They said that they can take anything they want without inventory. And then the cop hands the photographer, our guy, Stacy, the lady's cell phone that they found in her tent and says, here, you take this, hand it back to her. The cop doesn't know who Stacy is, yet he hands somebody's personal property to a total stranger with instructions to return it. Oh, come on. This is just totally illegal. And, you know, as far as I know, the city's going to be like, well, we didn't do anything wrong, because that's what they always do. We didn't do anything wrong. And then, you know, the last line will always be, well, we'll let a judge decide. You know, that's usually what they do. They let the judge decide. Even though they know they're breaking the law, they still want the judge to tell them.
Well, I think all those homeless folks look alike to them. So they figure you're all,
yeah,
you know.
Kind of, sort of, except there's uh-huh. a little problem. There's a lot of black homeless folks and a lot of white homeless folks, and we don't look alike. You know, so, and there's a lot of men and there's a lot of women, and we don't look alike. Yeah, you know, so they can't keep lumping us all into one package. We are not one package. You know, with the differences in the problems on the streets, there is a line in color, there is a line in sex. You know, I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. Black people do not get treated the same as white people. Men do not get treated the same as women. LGBT do not get treated the same as straight. Okay, these are just the facts of life out there. And the way the people are treated directly relates to the crew that is running the shelter or the intake or whatever. They work in cliques. You'll have the clique come in and they got their group of friends that are in the homeless community and they'll get preferential treatment. That's what's going on in Berkeley right now, which I just had a couple of complaints earlier today. We're going to look into it from the senior center. I don't know if it's true or not, but we've been receiving complaints from all of these organizations for the last 3 years we've been in Berkeley. And usually it has to do with discrimination, and the harshest discrimination is LGBT.
Has there been any follow-up in the court case involving Here or There, also known as First They Came for the Homeless, around the judge's order that both Berkeley and the camper's attorneys present programs that show proposals for at least in some kind of emergency housing, by the which we mean tenting in some cases, for homeless people? I understand, you know, both sides presented their so-called proposals. I use so-called more with an eye toward looking at the city's proposal. But that was back at the end of November, and now we're the end of December. What's happened with that?
Well, we did. Our proposal, we came out with, you just need to put in a lot of tent cities. That was a simple proposal. What the city did, though, is they did exactly what the judge said not to, and they just gave them the list of what was already there. You know, and what they're proposing to do now when they get funding to do it, which is the Pathways Project and the Stair Center, you know, both of which we object to because we consider them concentration camps. You know, what the city's trying to do is they're going to put something in place, and they're going to use that as an excuse to go out into the community and conduct raids on homeless encampments that are there to try to force them into that place. Now, the place that they're discussing, first off, isn't going to a allow you to stay indefinitely. There's a time limit. So they're going to harass you in and then kick you back out. That's an issue we have. Another issue is any type of navigation center needs to navigate you into something. That something does not exist. They do not have affordable housing right now. So what is the purpose of this? The purpose is to get the homeless out of sight, to shuffle them out of Berkeley, to pressure them away into a local, you know, a neighboring city perhaps. Maybe put them on a homeward bound bus to a situation that looks better but really isn't better. You know, the whole idea, though, is to get them out of sight and get them out of town.
What's your analysis of some who call this organization, well, the organization BOSS, which some call a poverty pimp organization, others praise? First of all, describe what it is, and then secondly, give me your thoughts.
Well, I don't really have any thoughts on BOSS, because here's the deal. When it comes to the services that Berkeley offers, I've never used them. I've never been into any of them. I got sick and tired of going into services many years ago and walking away with lights. So I'm not going in. It's as simple as that. I'm going to try to come up with another solution that's better, which is what we've done with the intentional community. You know, as far as BOSS goes, Buna Chima, who is the one of the ladies responsible for BOSS, is in our coalition. She, I don't think, has been involved with BOSS for several years, but when she was involved with BOSS, BOSS was doing a very good job. And we've heard that there's been funding cuts and all these other things, and the funding from these other groups got funneled into the hub, which is the group that's not doing their job. You know, and that's where it sits right now. So is BOSS funded properly to do a good job? I don't think so. I don't think any of them are funded to do a good job. The only group in town that's doing a really good job is HACC, the Homeless Action Center, which is where I went to get my Social Security case handled. Those guys are good. They did everything that needed to be done. They did it quickly. They did it efficiently. And they kept in contact with me so that I knew everything that was going on. And that's critical. When a homeless person is out there on the streets kind of just flapping in the breeze, they need an anchor, and that anchor is information that progress is being made in their case. Now, the hub never contacted me at all. They left me hanging. They left me hanging for 3 months on furniture, 6 months on a nurse that I need to survive. They just let it go like it was not important at all. So I think that, you know, that there needs to be a close look at everything that's going on in Berkeley with all these organizations, and it needs to be done not by the city, but by an independent group who can analyze this that doesn't have an agenda. You know, right now, the city government's agenda is still gentrification. It's still police state, urban shield. You know, let's use pepper spray on protesters. You know, Berkeley's going backwards still. We thought with the new administration that some of this backward slide would be halted. No, it's sped up. It's sped up. We're getting worse and worse and worse over there. Your rights are gradually eroding. Your ability to object to having your rights eroded is now, with the pepper spray, it's dangerous. I can't even go out on the streets now and protest, because if they pepper spray me, they can kill me.
So the protest at City Hall, though, that part of first they came for the homeless, now has increased from 10 tents and however many people they contained to how many, and how is it being treated by police?
Okay, what we have at City Hall is an interesting dynamic, okay? We're not going to be able to keep drugs and alcohol out of City Hall. So we knew that. I didn't really want a whole bunch of people there, and I didn't want a large occupation meeting length of time. But what's happened is the group that came in, there are people who use drugs. These people are actually behaving and contributing, so we've kind of backed off a little bit on that. We had an incident, you know, where there was some violence, and our people said, no, that can't happen here, go away. But what we're looking for is we're looking for some of the addicted people to get involved and to come up with a solution for addiction. A non-addicted person is not going to come up with a solution for addiction. They're going to sit there on the outside looking in and offer advice. Now, I'm an alcoholic, and I'll tell you right now, I never would have quit drinking if I had not gotten myself positioned in my mind to quit drinking. And that's what we need to come up with, a plan where we can get the addicts to fix their mind. And once they fix their mind, I'm betting that they're going to be happy enough to, you know, maybe cut back a little bit or outright quit when they realize that this is not living. You know, doing drugs is not a life. Doing drugs is a death.
So how... I,
I'm asking questions that sound a little kind of mechanical to me, but how large is the Berkeley City Hall encampment?
I can count tents. Okay, we had 10 in the center where the solar panels were. We had 3 up on the steps, and then we had like 9 or 10 off to the side, which is the side yard, so to speak, in the trees and the bushes. There's a little nice lawn area that's got 100-foot trees above it. That's the side. That one is growing right now. And last time I was there, they were trying to install a pop-up in front of the police station, or not in front of, but on the side of the bulletin board that the police station is on. I'm sure you remember that long bulletin board that goes down the sidewalk in front of City Hall.
I do, actually.
Yeah, that's our dividing line. Okay, when we occupy City Hall, we keep the side that we're on now, and then if there's problems or, you know, if people aren't going to behave properly, we put them on the other side of that wall, right in front of the police station, so that the police can sit there and look at all the crime.
And how are the police reacting to the encampment?
They're not doing anything. They're very pissed. Their hands are tied. They know their hands are tied right now. If they make a move that's the wrong move, it's not going to look good. And what they did yesterday with raiding this lady 3 days before Christmas without proper notice and taking all of her stuff, you know, I'm thinking this poor lady had medicine in her tent. You know, if they did it to me, and I'm well known, if they're going to do it to me, they're going to do it to a lady who nobody knows about. You know, what if she's a diabetic? What if she's insulin dependent and they just grabbed her insulin? What if there was a needle there because she was insulin dependent? You know, and here's the deal. They didn't find any needle. You know, they didn't find anything but some moldy food that was there in her tent, and that's it.
And how is she doing now? Have you been in contact with her?
I don't know. I haven't heard back from Stacy, who is running the camp across the street from her.
Mm-hmm.
But we know who she is. You know, so Stacy, he's very good. He's going to be over there. He's going to be looking into her well-being. And if there's an issue, they'll call me, and then we'll go ahead and try to figure out what we can do for her. Most likely what we're going to do is end up getting her another tent and trying to get her someplace that's not going to be a problem.
Some years ago, there was an active Oakland Union of the Homeless, and in more recent days, attorneys like Anthony Prince and activists in Salinas like Wes White have gotten together in Sacramento working on this thing called the Poor People's Campaign to pick up on supposedly where Martin Luther King and his successors left off in 1968. The Union of the Homeless did numerous things, but it was strong in Oakland during the late 80s and early 90s. Do you see any such organizations rising again?
Well, my co-founder, Sarah Menefee, I believe that she was instrumental in the formation of the Homeless Union back in the 80s. Mr. Prince did contact me last year and ask about joining up with what he was doing down at Salinas, but we didn't. We ended up just trying to deal with Berkeley. If we divide our concentration, then it's not going to be as effective. And I'm very confident that if we can do this in Berkeley, and if we can win in Berkeley, that other places will follow. You know, if we can get the intentional community, a sanctioned tent city that's put in properly, that's run not by the city, but by the people in the camp with the community coming in and talking to them, then we'll be able to solve the problem. The thing is, no community out there wants the homeless camp in their neighborhood. I understand that. I'm not going to necessarily agree with what they say, but I'm going to understand it. So let's find another location. Let's not stop the process because somebody says no. Let's work around the no and come up with a solution that's a yes that helps people.
So Dignity Village in Portland, as you may remember, which began in a sort of a similar fashion to First the Camp for the Homeless in Berkeley, began as a mobile homeless camp called Dignity Camp. Of course, they also had a suspension of their camping ban in Portland, Oregon in 2000 under the Wicks decision. But they were eventually, you know, supplanted to an area in sort of in a distant part of Portland, established their own little approach, and, you know, or their own, you know, their own independent approach. But it was all, I don't know if it had that much impact on the broader population of Portland, although there were, you know, other organizations that arose, particularly around the Occupy movement, even before the Occupy movement, which in essence continued the protests and weren't simply content to simply, you know, sit on the outskirts of Portland and look on. Do you have any sense of any kinship with either Dignity Village or any thoughts about it?
Well, I know who they are, and I agree with what they're doing. You know, I agree that what Portland did is they kind of sanctioned, and there's multiple camps in Portland. This is where Stacey just came down from. R2-D2 was there, and he was in R2-D2, and he was someplace else, which may have been Dignity Village. And then there was this Crystal Heaven, I believe.
R2-D2 is the right to rest, as I believe it, right?
Yeah, I think so. And R2-D2 is open to anybody, and I believe it's at Portland City Hall. And that it's been there for a while, and they've been fighting to maintain and keep bathrooms in and all these things. You know, but Stacy's really the one that you should speak to on that, because he's the one that's to and from Portland on a regular basis. You know, we do have a Portland chapter, but we're not related to R2-D2 or any of the other homeless camps. We just have a group of people up there that used to occupy with us that are interested in organizing something, and they're just keeping us up to date on what's going on in Portland.
Any reports on how things are going in Oakland?
No. I have contact now with the new SOS group, which is Safe Open Spaces. I went to a meeting with them a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if that's going to turn into anything. It looks like what they're trying to do is, you know, Oakland is trying to build a coalition also. And we've already got our coalition, and our coalition kind of crosses city boundaries. It's kind of a Bay Area coalition. So we are going to help them out. Any resource that I have is, of course, theirs to use, because we're all in the same fight. If we can develop a larger coalition and get more people involved on the ground, meaning an occupation, a sizable occupation, we can put some pressure on. Is the occupation in Oakland the solution? I don't know. Oakland police play different. I don't like the way they play. I don't like seeing my friends get hurt. And I've seen that happen like a dozen times doing these things. You know, when you're trying to fight for your rights and the cops don't want you to have them and the cops have sticks and guns, you tend to lose a lot more than you win.
Have you got connections with any of the folks in the Oakland encampments?
I have. I'm on an email list with the village, and the SOS group includes Coalition of the Homeless in San Francisco and a few other organizations. I'm not sure if RAP is involved. I haven't talked to Paul or Jonathan directly about the SOS group. I think Paul's up in Oregon right now. I think he's doing a talk or something, some type of seminar on the right to rest. I'm not sure. But, yeah, what we want to do is we want to get bigger. We want to start talking to a bunch of people. The solution in the Bay, you know, Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley, all these little areas, is the entire Bay needs to come together, and the cities need to work together. The fear that homeless jump city boundaries and go from city to city, yeah, okay, it's real. Some homeless do. But I hate to say it, most homeless don't leave their neighborhoods. If they become homeless in San Francisco, they tend to stay in San Francisco. You know, and it's a myth that they're going to leave San Francisco and run to Berkeley. No, if that was the case, there'd be 50,000 homeless people in Berkeley, none in Oakland, none in San Francisco, and none in the other surrounding suburbs. You know, so that's obviously not the truth. But if we can get that big group of people, then we can start applying pressure. Then instead of marching down the street, we can put 50 people in front of City Hall in tents and just sit there and say, no, we're not going to move until you guys start doing the right thing. And then, you know, take the arrest. You got to take some arrests as part of the fight. We've never had a conviction on any of our arrests, and we've had hundreds of arrests over the last 6 years.
Any reports on the lawsuit that OSHA Newman was involved with involving Caltran and the seizure of property?
No, I know that it's going on, but I'm not up to date on anything that OSHA is doing.
Anything you want to talk about that's happened in the last month or two that we haven't covered?
Not really. We're in between right now. As you know, we've got stuff going on with court cases. This raid yesterday opened up a can of worms for the city. I don't know if the press has seen the videos yet, but they are up online. panels in the paper, the fact that we are minimalistic and we are doing off-grid homeless camps, trying to be completely self-sufficient, this is big news. You know, I don't know if people understand the importance of self-sufficiency and minimalistic living at this point in our history. Our country is going to hell. Everything that we have been told, every way that we've been told to be, is blowing up in our face. Home ownership, it's a myth. It can't happen anymore. Homes are too expensive. You know, land, that's not for us anymore either. That belongs to the rich. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to come up with a different approach that really gets back to the basics of homesteading. You know, they did away with homesteading, I believe, in 1988. If they put homesteading back in and allowed homeless people an acre of land or whatever, you know, in a tiny home that's like $15,000 to $20,000, you can do it completely off-grid. What we would have is a new, I don't know how to put it. It would be something new that is old, and something that would get us back to the basics of what developed our country. You'd have farming going on, small farms, you know, people be growing their own food again, which would be healthy and hopefully organic. You know, people would be coming up with alternative energy sources. They wouldn't be contributing to the pollution on our planet. You know, they would be able to either harness or harvest their water or develop their own sources of water. Everything that it used to be, that's where we need to get back to. You know, chasing money around is what got us here. Getting away from money and starting to realize that everything that we need in life is sitting right there for us for free. That's how we're going to win this fight.
And again, if people want more information about not just First They Came for the Homeless, but what's going on in the Bay Area around different homeless movements or movements of folks who are outside struggling for civil rights, where do you suggest they go?
Join First They Came for Homeless on Facebook, if you do Facebook. We're pretty good at keeping up with local stories. We also cover some of the national stories, but if it happens in the Bay Area, we put it up on the page. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to give other groups exposure. You know, we've got exposure. First They Came for the Homeless is known nationally, so, you know, that's good for us. That's good for our message. But the group like The Village, they got some exposure, but at the same time they were doing their little thing, we were 2 miles down the street doing our thing. We were getting three times the press. They had a good message. They had an excellent message.
Tell us who The Village is.
What?
Tell us who they are, because I've never heard of them.
The Village is the group that established a drug and alcohol homeless camp with rules. They did it under, I believe it was a freeway overpass or a couple of freeway overpasses at a park in Oakland. And what they did was they walk in and they set up a couple of tents, then they start building tiny homes. And then they bring RVs on, okay? So they ended up with, I don't know, maybe 20 people. They had, you know, maybe three or four RVs parked up there. I saw four tiny homes that were being built when I was, five, you know, out of pallets. You know, it looked pretty good. It was clean. And there were people that were actually starting to feel comfortable again. I saw some smiles. I saw some photos of some people that were drug and alcohol free that saw an opportunity. And then the OPD came in and removed that opportunity because of complaints. You know, there's always complaints when poor people are actually succeeding in getting themselves off the streets.
Indeed. This is about a year and a half or 2 years ago, right?
It was about a year ago, a little bit less than a year ago.
And because I think I we went down to that place the weekend after it was removed, actually, myself, Wes White, and other activists to kind of see. I think we were there a couple of days late, but I think it was after, or before last year in December at City Hall in Berkeley when, there are different places where First They Came for the Homeless was moving at that time. So I'm, whenever it was, is The Village back, or is it essentially gone?
It's gone. It's gone. They are doing maybe another village. I didn't get that information. You know, I don't have direct contact. I have indirect contact through other people and through the meetings, you know, these phone meetings that we do. It's not like you can sit down and ask questions. So you've got 30 people on these phones, and everybody wants to say stuff. It ends up getting very confusing. But if we did have a sit-down meeting, you know, which I would love to do, have a huge meeting of everybody that's involved in the Bay Area and just start hammering out a strategy to try to get these encampments sanctioned. You know, that's the goal. We have got to get sanctioned encampments in for the homeless as soon as possible. Without them, you're going to lose another 40,000 homeless this year. It's horrible how many homeless people are dying. And what's even more horrible is you're not going to find out. You're not going to be able to get an accurate number. But I'm looking at little bits and pieces of the story, how over 100 died in Sacramento last year. You know, I'm in Berkeley. We had 8 die in Berkeley last year. Now, so let's sit here and do some math. There's 19,000. I looked this up. There's over 19,000 incorporated areas in our country. If the average is like Berkeley, you do the math on that.
Can you hold for a second?
Yeah.
Hang on. We're back with Mike Zint. So, Mike, anything, as I guess I'm repeating myself, but anything else you want to add that, you know, you think we should know about before wandering on, or before I wander on?
Not really. I mean, what we're doing right now is we're concentrating on accumulating gear for the winter months for the homeless, and we're trying to get people to understand some of the important things that homeless people need for the next 3 or 4 months. Number one is going to be socks. You know, get these guys some clean, dry socks if it's been raining. Otherwise, they get foot rot. That's not a pleasant thing when you're homeless. You know, also keep in mind that a cup of coffee when you see a homeless man on the streets is the one thing that will set their day off to a wonderful start. It's really good to wake up cold to a warm cup of coffee. You know, and it's not that expensive. You're not contributing to, you know, an addiction. Well, yeah, coffee addiction. But you're not contributing to something that's, you know, heroin or alcohol. What you're doing is you're making somebody feel good in a good way. And it's Christmas, you know. It's nice that the people that are on the streets for the next week or so are going to get a lot of good handouts, you know. But don't stop it at Christmas. These people get abused every day of their life. They get looked at bad. They get kicked around by cops and city officials. You know, it's a smile, you know, and a, hey, how you doing? You know, anything like that, anything that's positive in the life of a homeless person will create so much good feel for the day that a lot of times, you know, that's the difference between sanity and insanity when you're homeless. And that's about it. You know, just remember they're people. You know, these people have mothers and fathers. A lot of them have kids, you know, and most of them got screwed. It's not because of drugs and alcohol. It's because of the capitalist system that we live in. That's why these people are on the streets. Money is more important than they are.
Thank you, Mike. We'll get back to you and hear more when we do.
Okay. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks, man.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed 1,000,000 men and now they want me back again, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies. Set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. No, I ain't marching anymore.
So that was I Ain't Marching Anymore from the album of the same name, an earlier release by Phil Oakes. Now let's go back to Santa Cruz, where I'm going to play a little something from Dreamcatcher, who I caught on the street, talking about, well, updating us on the gloomy situation for a homeless person who, he says, is being targeted by Parks and Rec Rangers. Let's hear.
It was 30 degrees then. It looks like it's cooling off now.
So it's about, about 2:10. I'm out here on, a parking lot across from the Calvary Episcopal. And it's December 19th I'm talking with.
Dreamcatcher.
And Dreamcatcher, I ran into you on the street briefly up the way. And you've got a swollen finger and your stuff's been seized and all kinds of stay-away order shit. What's going on?
That is true, but I want to first say that we have the Christmas dinner at the Moss Center, not at the Red Church, and that's at about noon to 3, and I'll be running the security there. And
will that be Christmas?
On Christmas Day, yes.
Okay, where is the Moss? Oh, Moss, M-A, it's the Museum of Art and History.
You got it, Museum of Art and History. I'll tell everybody as I can, but the issue of confiscated personal belongings, when they know exactly whose it is and don't tag it so I can retrieve it, is a very good system to keep me from retrieving my very, very, very personal belongings. The system that they have set up keeps me from obtaining, in a nice way, without yelling, without cussing, without any type of anything except yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, and, okay, I'll come back, ma'am. That's all they let me say. And this system about whatever it is, I'm not going to call it anything, but that's what it is. I've been through it many times, and I have not been able to retrieve anything except for a phone call from a very high-up person that says, give Dreamcatcher all his stuff back. Now, it's so mixed up back there, I'm not even sure if there's anything of mine back there anymore. I can't identify anything in a black plastic bag.
I remember I talked to Abby Samuels, who actually she called me up. She was really upset. This is a couple of days ago. This happened to you. And she said, have you heard about what's happened with Dreamcatcher? And I said, yeah, I have. I get regular grim reports every fucking time I talk to him because it's pretty bad. And also, she hadn't heard that you had been declared persona non grata at Loudon Nelson because, what, you were slow in leaving one morning?
Yes, gosh darn it. When it's cold, and I wasn't in anybody's way, and it wasn't going to stop the world if I didn't, like, snap to at his orders, and then he makes up another ticket, and now it's 3 months or 3 weeks I got to stay away instead of 3 days, 3 weeks, because I didn't move fast enough on the first order of this ranger.
And the ranger's name?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. You didn't know before either.
I don't even remember since they took my stuff, the dates on the tickets that they gave me. I don't know anymore.
How have you been? How have you doing in the last few days? Anything new come up?
No, I don't even say hello to them.
And do they don't give you tickets then, the last couple days?
No, I haven't, because I've been in my safe zone.
And that means, from where are you now excluded?
On the east side of the San Lorenzo River, on the far side of Ocean, on the far side of Laurel, and on the far side of Center Street. I cannot come within those parameters.
And that was by judge or by cop?
That was by judge because of all the tickets that I accumulated, in protest demonstration.
Did you get any help from, or offers of help from Freedom Sleeper people to help with those citations or to go with you in court?
Yes, they would do anything I'd ask for. I've never been to court, so they took me, they issued this stay-away order because I never went to court on any of them.
And so this was issued in your absence?
No. They gaffled me up in front of Starbucks like they usually do and took me away.
And you were held for how long?
It was on the first time, it was over the weekend. And the second time...
Hey, you guys know this guy, he just died yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Jose?
By the bus.
Yeah, I heard.
Cement truck.
What's his name, do you know?
Yeah, it's right there. I don't have my glasses.
Let's see. Can you hold this for a second?
Yes.
So we're looking at a Tamarack showing me a picture on a video.
Juan somebody, and he used to sit with us quite a bit.
Mohammed Ben Tabit.
Oh, there we go.
That's his name.
It wasn't Spanish after all.
So this
frequently
is
used the name Joaquin.
Joaquin, yeah.
But what happened, I saw him 3 days ago, and he was all cut down here, major surgery. I mean, just walking like he was dead.
He survived? Oh, but he died?
No, he got on a bus. He got off the bus, and a cement truck ran him over yesterday.
I was approached by a social worker to see if I could find out who his friends were, because they had to have a memorial service. Yeah. He was a fellow drummer, and though I saw him a lot in the mall, I was not
That's
friends.
That's from Rick Walker.
Right.
It's from Rick Walker. So, if anyone wants to call in and talk about this man who was recently killed.
Okay. All right. Excuse me.
Thanks, Tamarack. No problem. Thank you.
Appropriate interruption.
Please give a call to 423-4833, and I'll be happy to include your thoughts on the next program that I do. Also, of course, by the time we're airing this, that homeless memorial will have come and gone. That's tomorrow, as you probably know, at the Homeless Lack of Services Center on Coral Street at 10 o'clock. You know, they read the names of the dead, and you might want to go and talk about what's happening to the alive.
Well, since all my bedding and everything was taken, my cot and everything, I'm sleeping on the ground again.
And unfortunately, I was in error. The homeless memorial was that day that we were speaking. But, that's what happened. Let's hear some more from Dreamcatcher.
My left shoulder is getting cold, and that's got arthritis in it. And I'm not a happy camper, but I'm not going to stop my teeth production because of it. But I do need to get a good night's sleep to get through this teeth pulling thing. And that's what I'm working on.
You have a dental appointment coming up.
Every Friday I get teeth pulled. I couldn't do it when they took all my stuff the first time. It was cold and raining. Yeah, I can't believe it, man. It's like all they had to do, I was at the vet center. And all I had nothing spread out. I just parked my stuff underneath there in case it did rain. All I had to do was just roll it out. But they unpacked everything and packed it in three trucks and drove away. And none of my stuff, they said I could go retrieve it that day. I go down there. I don't see any of my stuff down there.
This was about a month ago?
No, this was just last week, last Thursday.
So it happened again?
Yes, twice. They've taken both my two of my outfits, all my... If I could put them in a lineup...
Same Ranger?
Yes. They all know me. I don't know what good I can do anymore. I've never been rude. I've never, you know, maybe I've had a bad day, but I've never been anything other than cordial. But I don't know why this they're so adamant, you know.
I'm gonna leave it there for now, and I'll pass on the account. That's the best I'm doing. And again, we've been talking with
Dreamcatcher, and I am very sincere.
Yeah, thank you, Dreamcatcher.
You got it, sir.
And a quick update here from the Sentinel. The county cannabis office is trimming its hours. Santa Cruz County cannabis licensing counter hours have been revised to 8 a.m. to noon and 1 to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, with counter consultations limited to 20 minutes. I haven't been to the county cannabis office in years. I think I went there once to get a card. I don't know if this is the same county cannabis office that issued individual medical marijuana cards, because I know that, of course, commercial marijuana sales, accessibility for sales, licensing for sales, will be coming up in January. through rather, I don't know, it's a rather restrictive process, which has been covered a bit in some of the good times stories, perhaps. I'm not entirely clear on it, since I'm not a cannabis producer or seller, but I am a critic of the restrictive laws, so there's no question I've been talking about that. I actually was going to get an interview with activist Mike Boyd, but I never got back to him. Hopefully I may do that before the next show. Mike is a man who has sued the city and the county for their medical marijuana tax, which I think is a worthwhile effort. I don't think he's been successful. I haven't heard he has, but he's tried. And on the profiteering front, there's a story in the Sentinel. Work begins on Big Pacific Avenue housing project. That was in last Thursday's Sentinel. Builder Barry Big Buck Swenson celebrated Wednesday afternoon, toasting the start of a $35 million Park Pacific development that in 2 years will offer 79 rental units, a ground floor restaurant, and fill a key downtown property vacant since the 89 earthquake. And that actually is going to be in the area where the old bookshop Santa Cruz used to be, before it was torn down and fell on the coffee roasting company, killing two people there who we tried to get out, but the police wouldn't let us do that. It's being bankrolled by our old pals, the Wells Fargo profiteers, and those of us who were fighting Wells Fargo Bank's bankster fraud back in the Occupy movement and spent years in court being falsely charged with felonies for it because we took over the vacant bank building, which is now being occupied apparently, or now finally is going to, after many years, is going to have some other bank is moving in there. There's never really been any effective compensation to families who were fraudulently divested of their money and their property by Wells Fargo. This is, as you don't worry, know where this is right next to the current Lulu Carpenters, and it's at the kind of the end of the mall near on the cross from the Verve area, if you know where the Verve coffee shop is. Barry Swenson bought the property for $6.25 million a couple years ago, and I guess Case Swenson, Barry's son, was thanking Wells Fargo for the wonderful help. And what's being built here, of course, are condos and so-called housing projects that aren't really affordable for poor people, and I would suspect not even for working people. But they are, I don't know if we call them luxury apartments. Well, that's as much of the story as I pulled out of the paper. More of the same in Santa Cruz. And we have another story in the Chronicle. Complaints and probes on judges are kept secret by ruling. And this is there's an agency in California called the Commission on Judicial Performance up in San Francisco that's supposed to take complaints about judges that are unfair. And I think I've filed a few, actually, in my time. And most recently I thought of filing one against Commissioner, now Judge, Kim Baskett for her abusive rhetoric toward me and her attempt to limit my coming and going from her courtroom, her intimated threats, and the way she's treated some defendants. And I think it's appropriate to file these complaints even if they don't go anywhere, because even though the Commission on Judicial Performance probably won't do diddly squat, and that's apparently has been the record of this rather toothless so-called watchdog group, it's still appropriate because the judges, particularly if you bring these complaints to the attention of the public, are under some pressure, and that is really what counts. Anyway, this judge, Suzanne Ramos Bolanos, ruled that the state constitution gives this Commission on Judicial Performance the power to shield certain records, effectively trumping the auditor, who is a character that may be supposed to look over the Commission on Judicial Performance. If we have any competence in that, I have no idea. Trumping his ability to, his or her ability to review the government agencies. And so apparently the voters made it clear in a 1994 proposition that amended the state constitution that only proceedings involving formal charges against judges would be public. So complaints are not public. And this case stems from a standoff between the commission and the auditor's office, which dates from August 2016, when a state legislative committee approved the first ever audit of this Judicial Performance Commission, which was established way back in 1960, to look over the commission's 2,000 judgments since then. Although the small but powerful agency can publicly discipline judges, including removing them from the bench, the state constitution allows commissioners to carry out the vast majority of their investigations and disciplinary actions in secret. The commission releases a summary of a complaint and the judge's reply in only a very small fraction of the cases that result in public disciplinary action. In other words, disciplinary cases where the commission finds the misbehavior to be relatively minor, it withholds the documents and issues a private reprimand. Complainants are given limited information on the progress and the conclusion of the investigations that do not result in public proceedings. So advocates for more public access have argued that this lack of transparency has led to leniency for bad judges at the expense of the public. Of course, the judges have complained the commission has penalized judges too heavily for minor missteps. And Joe Sweeney, whose advocacy group Court Reform has pressed the state legislature last year to order an audit of the commission, he said he was encouraged that the ruling was headed for an appeal because apparently this judge who said, no, you can't audit them, is going to have her ruling examined by a higher court. These little hierarchies looking into each other's decisions is not terribly reassuring to me, I'll tell you. It is crazy that this judicial agency that has complaints about public officials that preside over our public court system isn't subject to any scrutiny, said Sweeney, whose complaint against a Contra Costa judge prompted a rare public disciplinary process this fall. The commission is funded by taxpayer dollars, and we have a right to know whether they're doing their job. And there's a senator, state senator, Hannah Beth Jackson, down in Santa Barbara, who was chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. She helped to initiate the audit, which so far has been blocked by this judge. She said, despite today's decision, I believe that no state agency funded by taxpayer dollars is above the law, nor above its financial responsibility to be accountable and transparent to the public. Commission operated on a $4.5 million budget last year. That's the Commission on Judicial Performance. It receives roughly 1,200 complaints a year, saw about 11,000 complaints from 2006 through 2015, according to a July court ruling by the auditor's office. In that time, the commission instituted only 19 public proceedings. That's 19 out of 11,000 complaints. Pretty closed up. Thus, in response to 99.4% of complaints, the commission made every decision at every junction secretly, free from public scrutiny. The commission has emphasized this is the main reason for only a small fraction of its cases result in discipline. That's the reason many complaints come from those who simply disagree with the judge's decision, and it maintains that private reprimands serve important purposes, educating the judge, deterring future misconduct, and justifying increased punishment for further violations. Confidentiality protects complainants, witnesses, and judges who may have been unfairly accused. It doesn't impress me because judges are in positions of extreme power. It's very important that there be transparency and accountability for these people who have such power with their gavel and their robes and their bailiffs, armed bailiffs, who can intimidate and do intimidate the public on a daily basis. In addition to review of the financial and staffing issues, the auditors sought to examine the commission's policies and practices for handling and resolving judicial complaints by reviewing those confidential records. Though the auditor's office said it would keep these records confidential, as it does with other sensitive records like tax and health, the commission argued that the state constitution grants it the authority to keep those records away from this audit and away from the commission. The auditor's office has refused to conduct the review unless it can get access to all the records it argues are critical to evaluating the commission's performance. Myron Moskowitz, the lawyer representing the auditor, said Wednesday he plans to appeal the decision. This is a story by Cynthia Dzikis, who's a San Francisco Chronicle writer. And I had more I was going to read from different publications, but I'm instead going to play a flashback, and I'll be describing that. I think I will describe that. So, this is a flashback which, one, you can actually review it yourself if you find it interesting and you want to go back and hear some more details about it. It's particularly pertinent to me because it concerns a couple of issues that are still important. Well, almost all the issues, sadly enough, that I've raised over the years haven't been resolved, but they're still in the process. Well, people are fighting for them or suffering under them. But you're going to hear initially this show breaks. I think we're actually only hearing a part of the show. It breaks into a discussion with Nancy McCready, or Nuff Said Nancy, as I used to call her, an activist in Santa Barbara who formed an organization called Homes on Wheels, which is a group of people who live in their RVs. And, of course, those of you who've been listening regularly to the show know that that's a really important issue for people in northern Monterey County on Lapis Road who are facing harassment by the county authority, by the sheriffs, by local city authorities, and by private agencies as well. This may be, but it's an example of what folks down there were trying to do when they were organizing. And then there's also, there's a lot of discussion of what was going on in Santa Cruz at that time, interviews and so forth, plus my critique of the city council under then-Mayor Emily Riley's crushing of the Citizen Police Review Board, which finally, under Chair Mark Halfmoon, was beginning to look into issues of the use of force, the display of force by the police, selective enforcement of laws against homeless people, and other issues that had long been ignored by the Citizen Police Review Board and certainly by the police department. It had been ignored ever since by the guy who replaced the board, who is a lawyer who gets paid essentially to issue private reports to the city council. There's a public aspect to them. I think he gives a verbal report. We don't get to see the details, and it's a closed process. It's Bob Aronson. It's still worth filing complaints because those complaints can be accessed by courts in cases where you're challenging the credibility of a cop. If he has a history of complaints of lying or complaints of force, that can come under some scrutiny, not by the public, unfortunately, but by a judge who can then rule it's relevant to a case, and so you can bring it up. So if you've got a lying cop or a brutal cop, and there's some, you can then call the witnesses, those people who filed those complaints. You're not going to get that information over by asking the police department. You're going to have to go through a judge to get it currently. So I want to remind you that all the times, places, and events mentioned here are long past. And so don't try to go to them because you'll be disappointed. My co-host in the show is a guy called Jeffrey Gale, who was very enthusiastic. He was with me for a number of months on the show, and I want to thank him wherever he may be. I haven't heard from him in years, but you'll hear his voice again today. Again, if you have any questions, comments, you want to be helpful in dealing with civil rights issues like researching police records or keeping a monitoring police conduct around homeless folks, give me a call at 831-423-4833. You can also find more information on the Huff website is at huffsantacruz.org. That's where the shows that I'm doing get archived. They're under the lost shows, not under latest shows anymore, because the latest shows is not archiving my shows properly. You're getting some strange gobbledygook if you go to latest shows, but you can find them under lost shows on the Huff website. Thanks for listening, and get in touch. Keep your eyes open on the streets, and remember, it's your eyes and your voice that counts ultimately. It really does. You may think that it doesn't, but I think you'd be wrong.